this month on Cannibal Halfling Radio.
This definition can be a little squishy, but at the same time, it's a good place to start.
Give yourself a little bit of leeway to have time to figure out what you're doing.
The kind of difficulty ramp in going from something like D&D 5th edition to any other system is perceived to be way higher than it is.
Everyone has to start somewhere.
I don't need to make you go explore the world. It's just, I think a lot of people want to, whether they realize it or not.
What we wanted to talk about this month in the great torrent of role-playing game discourse, there's always this thing about how do you get people to play more games? And how do you get people to play different games? So what I thought we could try to take on tonight is the traditional role-playing gamer's intro to indie games. Both of us here... oh, by the way, hi, I'm Seamus, and that's Aaron over there.
Hi, I'm Aaron. No, we just really like jumping right into the topic at hand. I mean, I started an entire one-shot without introducing anyone. Did I introduce the game? I think I did, but I'm not sure. Anyways, I'm Aaron. This is Seamus.
Both of us come, at least originally, from, like, traditional, quote-unquote, gaming backgrounds. My first game was AD&D 2nd Edition.
Mine,
I didn't
too.
Know it was 2nd Edition at the time. Same for you. And yet we've both done a decent job at branching out. So, if you are already into indie games, this episode might not have a huge amount of practical value for you, but I hope it's still an interesting listen. Hope we can make it interesting. And if you're coming from a traditional game standpoint, I hope we can make taking your first steps into a larger world a little easier. But I think the first thing we need to define before we do that, though, is what is a traditional game? Now, Aaron, I'm putting you on the spotlight because you wrote the article about it.
Yes, I did.
And I'm a cheap little bugger. What makes a role-playing game traditional? Now, we know that there's the game with, you know, the underground prisons and the giant lizards. We know that's traditional. Why is it traditional, and what makes other games traditional?
Now I want to write prisons and lizards, but let's talk about traditional games broadly. And what's interesting is that the opposite of traditional is not indie, so you can start looking at non-traditional games that are more in this mainstream, I was going to say tradition, because let's just kill a word tonight. Just kill it dead.
Yeah, sure. Let's just butcher that sucker.
But when I did write the article that Seamus is alluding to, called Traditional Games and Why We Love Them, I identified three basic pillars that make a game traditional. One is that there are players and a GM, and each player has one character. One is that the rules are concerned with simulating a world. And what that means is that the rules care about what you are doing, how you are interacting with the objects around you. The rules do not necessarily care about abstract concepts like the story going on. And finally, all traditional games use a randomizer. Now, one of the interesting conversations I had after writing this article was someone who pointed out that even though I used the game Dread, which famously uses a Jenga tower to determine when your characters are all going to die in a horror scenario, as an example of an indie game, Dread, by my definition, is a traditional game. Because there's a GM, each player has one character, there's a randomizer in the form of a Jenga tower, and the rules are concerned with an event that leads to characters' deaths, which is an in-world event. Now, that last one is the one place where I could argue, but the person who stated this to me made some very compelling points. And that just goes to say that this definition can be a little squishy, but at the same time, it's a good place to start. Now, when we're talking about traditional gamers, we start going into other things, and that's simply because there are hundreds of games out there, but if you're going to start counting off games that have ever sold more than, let's say, a million copies over their entire publication history, we're down to maybe a couple dozen at absolute most.
Yeah, and that might be generous too.
Well, GURPS is on that list. It's probably near
GURPS,
the bottom.
GURPS, the
D&D at the top.
With the prisons and the prisons and the lizards, obviously.
And then
Shadowrun's probably another.
Shadowrun's in there. Vampire the Masquerade is in there. The Fantasy Flight Star Wars games are in there. They're probably the most recent ones that are. If you're doing entire publication histories, you can probably throw in Warhammer Fantasy. Maybe.
Yeah, four editions worth.
Call of Cthulhu over its entire history, yes. A seventh edition is not quite cracked the million mark from sales figures I've seen. It still does quite well in the whole scheme of things, but across its entire publication history, yes, easily. Traveler, another one. The Traveler is very front-loaded. When it was very popular, it was early on in its publication history. But the point is, we're talking about a relatively small number of games that most people are coming from. Oh, duh, Cyberpunk.
I was wondering why that wasn't being brought up, and obviously you're the local expert, so I'm like, I don't know.
I forgot about it, partially because I snarkily like to say that by the loose standards of the New York Times bestseller list, Cyberpunk 2020 is the best-selling role-playing game of all time.
But, gotta love those standards.
Exactly.
I feel like this would probably be a good time just to get... This is a niggling little thought that I just want to get out of my brain. Is that, before we go any farther, there's two different two different grades. When you're talking about traditional indie. And first, you're right. Traditional indie are not exactly opposites, so this is very shaky ground. But you've got traditional and indie publishers, and over on the traditional side, you've got maybe it's less than the people who've sold a million games.
Yeah, because a lot of the people who were like doing numbers in the 80s are gone. Like another one we didn't mention, though I'd have to really do some digging to confirm these sales figures, but if someone told me that Rifts sold over a million copies, I'd believe them. I don't know for certain. I find that plausible. Palladium's a non-entity now, other than the fact that they recently licensed the Rifts setting to Pinnacle.
Mm-hmm.
Mark Miller, who wrote Traveler, I mean, licensed Traveler to Mongoose, and I think he might have had a Kickstarter for a fork, but like, not moving copies like he used to in any way. And GDW, the original company, is gone. West End Games, gone.
Yep.
These were big back in the day. And I mean, like, you know, even some of the ones that have persisted, like Chaosium and Atlas Games, are just... they're just not the same. Steve Jackson Games, perfect example. They started saying they barely made money in RPGs almost a decade ago.
Right. Yeah, that's a long time in game terms. And what are we up to, like a 45-year-old industry somewhere in that range?
Thereabouts, yeah.
Hold on, let's see. Hold on, I know this. It was 40 years in 2014, so I imagine 47 years or so. So a decade is a very long time to, quote-unquote, not be making any money.
Well, you have to understand that when that was stated, and one thing that Steve Jackson Games does is they have their letter to the stakeholders every year, and because I ran a lot of GURPS, I started reading their letters to the stakeholders in 2006, and I've read every single one since then. Here's what happened. Munchkin happened. So don't feel too bad for Steve Jackson James.
No, they're doing fine.
One of the reasons, I mean, there's other issues going on now, but that has more to do with some economic issues that's a board game thing, and we're not Cannibal Halfling board gaming because I couldn't, I'm sorry. Anyways.
Because board gaming reviews are hard. Anyways. Because
I don't like many board games, actually. I like a few.
That's fine. But... that's fine. I like plenty. I just find them very hard to review. And so, to get back to my point. On the one axis, you have traditional publishers, of which there are very, very few.
One. Really. Maybe three.
You could make... well, see, it's even less than I would have thought. Because, like, I would have tipped the hat to... FFG with Asmodee behind them, but now it's Edge Studios, and they haven't done anything in like 2 years.
Well,
so
there's that, but I'd basically say there's one for sure, which is Hasbro.
There's one for sure. Yeah, there's one we can't argue about, and that's, you know, and the one with the mage users and the waterfront property.
You know that we can say the name of the game, like it's fair use.
Yeah,
right?
I know. I'm just being cheeky,
but. There are two, which then there are strong arguments for in terms of doing volume and having money, which would be Paizo and Fantasy Flight / Edge / Asmodee / whatever, which,
whatever's
considering
going
on they reordered, you then go, okay, so they're not doing so great. Then the next stage down is you have three-ish... which make enough money that you can kind of call them publishing houses, which would be Modiphius, Free League, and Magpie. And, you know, someone's going to say, well, what about White Wolf? Paradox dissolved White Wolf.
No.
Paradox no, dissolved White Wolf, so Modiphius is actually the one publishing any remaining White Wolf games. And Onyx Path is a piece of paper that writes checks to freelancers, so they definitely don't count.
White Wolf got dissolved in a vat like the shoe in Who Frames Roger Rabbit, okay? It was unpleasant. There was a lot of screaming.
Yeah. Though that is something that I will note about those 3, 2, 5. They have full-time staff. Not a lot of them.
Right.
Not a lot of them, but they have at least some. Onyx Path famously has none in terms of design staff. It's all freelancers all the time.
All the time. So you've got the one, maybe you can argue two or three, traditional publishers. You've got the weird sort of small folk in the middle. And then you got everybody else on the indie side of publishing.
Yeah. You do have a couple hangers-on. Mostly the ones I mentioned already. Like Steve Jackson, like Pinnacle, like Atlas Games, like Chaosium. But they're basically 1980s businesses that are riding the wave until either they go bankrupt or the guy who started it finally retires. Which,
right, yeah.
In at least one case, there's only one of those options left because the guy who started it has since passed away. But, you know, Chaosium will go forever. And, you know, good on them, but Kalkaboo 7th edition. Come on, guys.
So that's on the publishing side of things. Yeah. Then you have the actual design thing. We've talked a little bit so far about what makes a game traditional from a design standpoint. And just because you're an indie on the publishing side does not mean you're getting particularly indie on the design side of things. I think we've talked about this before a little bit somewhere at some point. Someone find out for me, please. But like, Powered by the Apocalypse games. Definitely from the indie side of publishing, but pretty traditional as mechanics go. You've got the one GM. Everyone's playing an individual character, usually. You're using a randomizer with dice. Like, all of the touchstones are there. You're usually building a world.
With one giant exception. The rules are not concerned with simulating the world. The rules are concerned entirely with what happens to each character.
True. That's a good point.
That's
a good point.
And that's one of the things that make Apocalypse World and other PBTA games indie. But since we're just starting to transition out of publishing, there's some interesting stories there, which is look at the PBTA games that are pushing the most copies, and I will promise you right now, Apocalypse World ain't one of them.
No, it's not.
But the big ones you can look at are games like Dungeon World and, more relevant nowadays, Monster of the Week. What both of those have in common is that they were picked up by other publishers, and then we get back into the traditional pre-tier publishing stuff again.
Yep. Yeah.
So there's crossover. Some indie games do get popular enough, just not most of them.
Just not most of them, because there's, frankly, there's a lot. The odds are against any one game. I don't want to stand on this soapbox for too long, but a certain amount of luck is required.
That's an understatement.
Unfortunately. More power to those who manage to snatch it. And then, of course, actually take advantage of it. Because sometimes you can get a lucky break and squander it. But I'm not going to get into how you manage that, because I have no idea at all. So let's take a look at some of the things of indie games from a design standpoint. Where did these games start to depart from that traditional framework that old school D&D players first cut their teeth on? We've talked a little bit about the PBA thing, about it cares more about the characters first. I'm doing a quick scan in my brain of indie games at large, and that might be a unifier. That might be a unifying thing across indie games, is that they really tend to focus on the characters more. Plot is secondary to character growth in a lot of them.
So this can all kind of trace its way back to one group, and that would be the fantasy authors and storytellers and fans that were first part of RPGs in the 70s. I'm not sure that that little gotcha is going to translate, but no, basically, since 1974, there were two groups of people attracted to role-playing games, and it was the wargamers who were responsible for writing things like Dungeons and Dragons and, you know, basically cursing us, and then it was sci-fi and fantasy fans who saw the storytelling potential in this and were the ones that famously kind of browbeat Gygax into including Tolkien's species in his game, which he originally did not care about. And they took it and ran with it, even though the rules never really helped them at all. Like, D&D was, is, and as long as it has brand equity, will be a war game at heart. That is not going to change. And it doesn't have to change. But that says where the gap is. All the storytellers are the ones looking for something to help them. And since that's where the gap is, that's where most of the designers want to push against what's mainstream go to, because that's the next biggest audience. And I just think it took a very long time for us to get like a really compelling story engine. You saw attempts at it for a long time. I mean, like, Fate. Fate is quite old. Technically, I think Fate Core is, it's either the fourth or the fifth edition of Fate, since Fate originally forked from Fudge.
I think it's fourth. They didn't do the number thing, so it gets a little fuzzy.
And then, like, you had some of the early, like, RPGNet darlings like Wushu, which was entirely based around, like, descriptions and Stumpton and all of that, and some of what Wushu did. And Wushu was, you know, a single guy. I want to say his name was Dan Bain. And eventually some of that parlayed itself into other games like Exalted. And then you had Burning Wheel, and that was like 2003, where, from all we can tell, Luke Crane took what was basically Shadowrun and tried to turn it into a more narrative epic. And in some ways succeeded, and in some ways failed. And I've written a lot about Burning Wheel, which basically it's a combination of very interesting and very neat to play, with definitely written by someone who's just a little bit insufferable.
just a touch. Nobody's perfect.
But the point is, you had different attempts, and you know, I'm probably glossing over some of the stuff that happened earlier. I remember in John Peterson's more recent book, The Elusive Shift, he was talking about one, I want to say it was called Legacy, but I might be getting that completely wrong. But all these interesting ideas, it was out in like 1977, 78. The game was terrible. Just incomprehensible. But it had all these ideas that would circle back around into the indie movement that just no one really knew how to execute on because everyone was still thinking about D&D, and to a lesser extent, Tunnels and Trolls. But then, you know, 2010 rolls around, the Bakers release Apocalypse World, and the rest, as they say, is history. And it's not that Apocalypse World went really hard on, this is all about writing stories. In fact, the fact that it didn't is probably one of the reasons it's so good. Because it just shifted the equation just enough to say, yes, this is a role-playing game. This is all about your characters. Make it about the characters. I don't care about your plus two sword of waving around and shit. What happens? Why do you have it? Why do you care about it?
I think that, I mean, I'm well known to be a fan of Powered by the Apocalypse games. I think that's why that particular rule set can sort of be a good first step, because it's not so far from what a player who has only played traditional games is used to. Like, it's just close enough to be an easy stepping stone, and yet it sort of ends up opening up the door. I mean, look what happened with our online group when we just ran that first game of Apocalypse World. That one moment where we were just like figuring out who all the characters were, the way that Masks went viral within the group and basically hijacked everyone's brains, and suddenly we're playing a Masks campaign,
right?
Because we wanted to find out what was going on with the characters, is I think a good example of how that particular rule philosophy can be a good stepping stone.
So one interesting thing, and this is one of, not the only, but one of the reasons that people like to rag on Dungeon World also, is that Powered by the Apocalypse is so close to kind of a lot of traditional role-playing paradigms that there ends up being cognitive dissonance.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
You can play Apocalypse World like you'd play D&D. It'll suck. And to some degree, some of the criticisms of the game, especially early on, were like, it doesn't do this, this, and this. It's like, yeah, it's not supposed to. Go back to the grid, or wherever it is that you're trying to calculate initiative. And with our group, I, as the person running that Apocalypse World game, felt perilously close to falling into that cognitive dissonance gap. And I don't remember if you were there, but we were doing the intro session, and I was just following the advice in the book, which is for the first session after you've all created characters, have it be a normal day. And I didn't quite make it a normal day. I made it a funeral. So it was still an event.
Right, yeah.
But the point was, don't introduce an overarching conflict.
Yep.
Don't introduce tension. Just tell them what's going on and ask what they do. And that's it. And a lot of it was like asking questions. It would get to the point I'm describing the scene and I start asking what our group now knows are like classic Apocalypse World questions, like it's like, what do you see there? What are you focusing on? And people were silent. They weren't understanding the question. Someone said, is there like a perception check?
No, I remember specifically Mike immediately went to do, I can't remember the name of the move, but the perception move,
right?
Basically. And I remember pointing out, well, Mike, I don't think Aaron is asking us to make a check. I think Aaron is asking us to tell him, just make it up. And there was a moment of silence. And then there was four or five voices all at the same time going, oh. and then it took off.
Yeah.
Then it's like, oh yeah, so there's a water treatment plant over the hill named Poland.
Right.
We're the gas station because we have the fuel refinery. There's an archive called Barney. I can't remember the name.
Bars and Knob. We really liked falling down signs. It was a great trope. We
really, really liked falling down signs in the campaign. But that was that moment of understanding. I don't think I'll ever forget that one, where we had that breakthrough of, oh, I get it now.
I could almost hear it pop.
Right? Like, it was so that there was literally a second of pure silence, and then all the light bulbs came on. And so I want to stick a pin in that.
Yeah.
As our, like, our first universal piece of advice for someone who's only played your standard, big quotation marks, role-playing game. When you're moving into indie stuff, accept that it's going to be different. It's not going to be what you're used to. And just give yourself a little bit of leeway to have time to figure out what you're doing. It's almost like learning how to role play from the get-go, like for your first session at a D&D beginner's night. When you started playing a traditional game, you didn't know what you were doing then either. And it's okay to not know right away what you're doing with a new game system. Whether it's a traditional, well, I think this is a very broad piece of advice, whether it's a traditional one where you're just jumping from trad game to trad game, or if you're diving into the ocean of indie games, yeah, there's going to be new stuff. Yeah, you might not get it at first. That's okay. We go back to that one half of the wheel. Just talk it out with your GM. Talk it out with your players, if you have a GM, of course. We'll get into that in a bit. Bang your head on the wall a little bit, and you will get that breakthrough. Or, honestly, you might not, and that's okay, too. I know we just joked about, get the hints back to the grid, but not every game is for everyone. So I know we're trying to pitch all of y'all on indie games and trying new things and whatnot, but also, don't be afraid to say, hey, this just isn't really doing it for me.
And I mean,
we talked a lot about that last time.
Yeah. A lot of this advice is just generalizable to trying new systems. Because I think one thing that a lot of people in the hobby kind of bemoan is that basically the kind of difficulty ramp in going from something like D&D 5th edition to any other system is perceived to be way higher than it is. Especially if you're jumping to another trad system. Like, I hate to say it, but like, if you're going from like D&D to Star Trek Adventures, there's 5 pages in the front of the book you need to read. It's trivial. As long as you understand rolling dice, and you might need to stop, oh, low is good. Okay. Let's roll some dice. I know they sell these big books, but as a player, like, it doesn't take that much time. It's like 30 minutes of investment, and then you read the character creation rules. And, I mean, creating characters in any system is like 45 minutes, and D&D is not good at streamlining that, so it'll actually be quicker, even if you don't know the system.
Well, it could be worse. Could be Shadowrun.
We're trying not to scare people off of trying new systems, Seamus.
Right, no, Shadowrun can be fun. Ignore me.
Shadowrun can be fun. So can hiking the Appalachian Trail, but you might want to start with a 5-mile loop.
Okay, I like that. I like that. Start off with the quick start. Get used to a couple things. Use some beginner games.
The fun thing about a lot of indie games, the thing I love about Powered by the Apocalypse games, is as long as you can print out the playbooks, like, it's even better. Like, you take 5 minutes to explain, okay, so it's a 2d6, 6 and below you miss, 7 to 9, it's a mixed result, 10 and above, it's a complete hit. Here's your playbook. If you have any questions about the moves, ask me. The basic moves are here in the middle of the table. Do I need to read the book? No. Next question. It's great! It's great! The only thing better is Electric Bastion Land. Should I read the book? No. Okay.
Like, at all? No. It's fine.
Don't. It'll be fine. Just don't. We'll read off some tables. We'll roll some dice. It'll be great.
The only reason for a player to read the book of Electric Bastion Land is to just enjoy reading about all the different backgrounds.
Yeah, and to come back to the whole trying new things, getting into a new breadth of games in your otherwise, Electric Bastion Land is kind of an OSR adjacent game, so if you have played D&D, you're gonna roll D20s and you're looking for, actually, it is still roll under, isn't it? But
It is, but it's only one die.
But you're rolling D20s, and it's like stats you're familiar with, and
the higher your numbers are, the better.
And you're probably gonna die because you start with 1d6 hit points, but you've played D&D, so when I say 1d6 hit points, you understand how bad that is because. That's kind of the subset of traditional games. Like, the OSR in general is a subset, which is just like, yeah, we're playing D&D. Well, isn't it more like, yeah, we're playing D&D.
Yeah, when it comes down to it.
There's a lot of other interesting things going on there. Mechanics, for the most part, is not one of them. And that's fun.
At the start of all this, we noted, like, three things that really make a game. One is that there is a GM. There is someone running the game.
Yep.
Let's say you're a traditional gamer. You're wandering into this game, and the game has no GM. It is, if you will, GM-less. What is that all about? How does that work? Let's try to make this little transition a little bit easier for people. Now, the first thing that I note whenever I look at a so-called GM-less game. I saw it with most of the games in Seven Wonders. I saw it with Alice's Missing. While they don't have an actual GM, they have something they call a facilitator or an organizer. So, yes, no one has that perceived veto power of a GM. Everyone's on the same page when it comes to power level, if you will. But going back to the board game thing, when you're teaching someone to play a board game, someone has to know the rules. Someone has to know what's actually going on. So step one, if you're playing a GM-less game, someone has to actually have read the whole thing and understood it. At least for that first session. Ideally then, okay, more people have played it, or more people have read the book, or the PDF, or whatever. But you still need for GM-less games that at least that one person you can turn to when you have a rule kerfuffle and go, what about this? And they go, oh, well, this is how that works. They just don't have the in-the-moment referee power that your traditional GM has.
So, I mean, the facilitator thing is important. That's, in some ways, the acknowledgement that, okay, the game has to be run somehow. And in board games, as you said, because we keep on doing the board game nights where people grab giant boxes enthusiastically out of their shelves and push them in front of us and say, we will play! And inevitably they are setting themselves up to be the one explaining and basically going through the procedures of the game because they're the only one who knows how to run it. So there's that.
Yep.
One of the dirty secrets about GM-less games is that unless they have rules structured someone like board games, it's hard to make them work. I've been part of a local area game design meetup and we've had multiple discussions that have gone something along the lines of like, you know, I've tried like three Belonging Outside Belonging games, you know, games like Dream Askew. And they never seem to work. And it's difficult because you basically need an entire table of spotlight hogs who are going to engage with the mechanics of, you know, in those games where you basically have tokens that allow you to make certain moves, you're working with this currency to let you play part of the game. And if half the table's quiet, well, then your economy's out of balance. So what I've started to see recently with games like Wonder Home, as an example, is that instead of saying there's no narrative GM, the game describes, I think Wonder Home is four different elements, and describes either running the game with a single kind of guide, who's basically a GM, or divided up that role among four people who are told narrate and push with these specific themes and ideas in mind.
Sort of a round robin sort of affair.
Yeah. So instead of saying there is no authorial voice, which was the thought of GM-less games, and you know the fact that they even exist is partially a pushback to some really screwy GMing behaviors that were considered the norm in the hobby for many years. But
GM as God.
Yeah, don't get me started on that. Yeah, so GM-less games, as a start, were kind of a reaction to the whole GM as God thing. But what, especially newer games, and I'm really talking the last, like, 18 months. That's one thing about indie games. Move fast, so...
Oh, yes.
So, there's a lot to keep up with and a lot of interesting stuff being written. But, you know, you look at Wander Home, where this whole guide role is broken up into four different, like, thematic elements. Yeah, now we're leaning even further into, let's make this really narrative, but the point is that there's an acknowledgement. The GM has a role, and that role doesn't go away just because you don't want a single person to have it. And the only games that really succeed without that role at all replace it with rules. And my favorite example of this, and it's a cracking game in its own right, is Fiasco.
Yep, I was wondering when Fiasco was going to rear its
head. Fiasco basically plays like a board game, and actually, if you get the second edition, there is a board. So
really?
It's mostly just like a... you know, a graphic organizer, because they've shifted from having it
yep.
be just the lists in the books to cards.
Oh.
It is a lot easier to teach. And there's certain randomization things with the cards that work way better than with the, like, roll all your dice and pick out numbers. So, point is, Fiasco has rules that say, okay, you have this many scenes, you have two acts, this is the order you go in, this is how you determine who your characters are. These are all in the book. And then you have specific playsets that kind of establish which elements you get to bring in. These are all written out. That's replacing the GM.
Almost like a... I mean, I would refer to it almost like an AI system. Like, I've run into that with a couple role-playing games and a couple, well, board games that do the single-player
route. Yeah.
It's basically a very low-tech AI who is running the game for you and reacting to what you do.
Well, that does exist somewhat on the trad RPG side. There's a game called Mythic, and I don't think Mythic as a game got a lot of recognition, except for the fact that Mythic had something called the Mythic GM Emulator, which was basically, yeah, kind of an AI rules engine to run a scenario or a dungeon crawl or what have you without a GM.
I remember there's this one game that's crossed my radar a couple times, Emberwind, where each monster or NPC or whatever had essentially like an AI, the dice-powered AI flowchart for what it would do in any given situation. So if you didn't have a GM, you could run it that way, just roll the dice, just look at what the situation is. Okay, are they in melee? Is there a spellcaster within dashing range? Is there da-da-da-da-da-da? Roll the dice to see which of the actions it performs, and then just play it out.
Yeah.
So, let's see. I suppose the cap on the GM-less question is, okay, first of all, someone has to read the book.
At least one person.
At least one person has to read the book. Someone is going to be the guide. And I think, I wonder how universal this statement is. Whether it's just GM-less games, or if it's all indie games. They're not super friendly to the quiet player. I state that that's true of GM-less games.
I see where you're coming with that. I think that has to do with a lot of things that are common in indie games, but don't really have anything to do with indie games, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, the more I mull it over, I don't think it's universally true of all indie games. Not that anything comes out of my mouth is universally true, but...
in a lot of traditional games, there are activities that involve dice. And if you're not comfortable talking a lot in front of a lot of people, there are still your dice, and there is still your base attack bonus. You don't have to move that far away from D&D to get to the point where, you know, your base attack bonus isn't going to help you anymore.
Right, yeah.
I mean, in something like Cyberpunk, you could still play a solo, but, like, there's going to be parts of that game that are more about, well, the roleplay. And, yeah, quiet players are going to have more trouble with that. I don't think you can place that squarely on indie games. What I will say is that in the case of a GM-less game, there's no backstop. There's no referee. The louder group will run roughshod over everyone else. But that just is an existing problem that is worse, not a new problem, if that makes any sense.
Right, yeah. It's something to be more aware of, not, you know, it's not a thing you discard. It's just once you go back to the trad games. So we've dealt with the GM-less thing.
Yeah.
As best we can. Talk to your players. Have someone read the book. All the advice that comes with dealing with a quiet player applies double.
Yeah.
Another common format, I think, for, and it's definitely, well, you know what, I'll say it, definitely just for indie games, the solo role-playing game. When you're on your own, there's no group, there's no GM, because you're it. What sort of challenges does that offer? What does that do for us? How can we make that transition easier for someone? First of all, why would anyone want to play a solo role-playing game?
So, that's a different activity. And first, I'm going to point out once again, no, you can't generalize that solo role-playing is only indie games.
I'm just running into the wall all over here.
Game books like Fight and Fantasy predate the notion of indie. They were solo.
I already mentioned
the Mythic GM emulator that is intended to help you run solo.
Right.
The difference there is that there is an activity. The game books tried to get it all in. And I mean, you know, the Fight and Fantasy books were more sophisticated than Choose Your Own Adventure, but kind of barely. And you look at other things like Mythic, and especially like, this is math to help me run combats against myself, basically. Okay. Mm. Like, some people like that. You could argue that Pathfinder build bench racing is a form of solo role-playing, and these are all trad. When you're getting into indie solo role-playing, it tends to be less of that game book action and more of what we typically call journaling games. That's like the indie iteration of solo role-playing. And the idea there is you're trying to get the same narrative boil going, basically, in your head that you would when you're in a group and you're interacting, you're really feeling like you're in the head of your character, but you're doing it on your own. And sometimes that's prompt driven, but the more sophisticated examples tend to mix prompts with a bit of game mechanic to kind of force you towards inevitable conflict. And the two examples I'm thinking of are The Wretched, where basically you have a Jenga tower and you are making pulls from the tower as you are reading prompts about being on this failing space station to see whether or not you die. And I'm oversimplifying it, I know. But it...
No, I mean, it's a pretty good simplification.
It's a neat game, but it's... I have trouble getting up the mental energy to sit down and play a game with myself, especially when I'm so behind on prepping all my sessions for games with other people. But the other example I can think of is called The Thousand-Year-Old Vampire. And that is chock full of prompts, but also has this really neat set of mechanics around the memories and the relationships that you keep and which ones you must discard as you go through the game. But what that one really relies on, what both of them rely on to some degree, but Thousand-Year-Old Vampire definitely relies on, is you're going to have to enjoy the writing. It is a journaling RPG.
Yep.
And that's kind of the activity, and how you're getting into your character is through writing. And if you like writing, that's awesome. And there is definitely an audience who really enjoys writing and would think it would be so cool to write this chronicle of this vampire and have it be 15, 20,000 words as they play through the long version of the game. A lot of people won't. And that's...
A lot of people will bounce.
That's fine, too. But I think the easiest thing to say there is, I don't think I should try to convince you to try journaling RPGs. I should just simply say, they're really cool if you like writing. And if you don't like writing, maybe save your time and money. I like writing, so that's why I own both the Wretched and Thousand-Year-Old Vampire. But that's me.
So... I've been taking a dive into these games this year with the whole solitaire storytelling thing, and just been reading a lot of solo games and playing more without putting them up as an article and eyeballing a few others. We talked the last episode, you mentioned the last episode, when we were talking about touchstones for a game.
Yeah.
About how a lot of indie games, your touchstone is taken care of just by the game itself, by it existing, almost sort of the same as D&D. With all the different solo indie RPGs out there, that touchstone gets distilled down to a very, very fine point. To someone who has never played a solo RPG before, who is getting into them, I would say, figure out what your favorite kind of story is. Is it a horror scenario? Is it an epic tale? Is it a romance? Is it introspection? Is it... There's going to be one for it. The thing about... You're absolutely right that there is a very, very blurry line between solo role-playing games as they are self-described and just creative writing prompts. Where it comes in, of course, is, you know, okay, you're rolling dice to determine this, or you're drawing cards to determine this. You need to start somewhere. I don't know, I think you're right that, okay, it's kind of a hard sell. You either like writing or you don't, but what if you're not sure? I think solo role-playing games are a great way to practice getting into the head of a character, to tell a very specific type of story that you want to tell. Frankly, to practice writing. Everyone has to start somewhere.
Yeah.
When it comes to writing, right? To someone who's, you know, I don't know, stuck in their house or their apartment or whatever because there's a plague outside and you can't play with your friends, a solo game can be, I think, a fascinating experience. That's my pitch to convince someone to play a journaling game, even if they're not interested. And it's sort of in the spirit of the whole episode where we're trying to convince you, hey, try out new things. There are these things that just work in a completely different way. Every time I've played a solo game all the way through, I've usually put it down after the fact and had a good long think about what I just did.
Yeah.
And if you can pull that off, I think you found a good one. Now, in terms of tips and tricks, and I know this is not universal, it might even be frowned upon. So, a lot of these games, as you say, they're gamified in some way. That was to make them a game instead of just a pure writing prompt. Yeah. In the Wretched, or the Wretched and Alone games that have since come out, because there is an SRD for it, you're pulling Jenga blocks. And drawing cards. The cards are probably the biggest part because the cards are what provide you with the prompts you need.
Right, yeah.
In other games, you're rolling dice to figure out what the prompt is. One thing I've often done, and I've done it recently often for the solitaire storytelling thing, is I roll out all the mechanics ahead of time. I might not look them up, but there's usually some sort of end state for them. In the Wretched, you die horribly.
Right.
I believe. In Wretched Alone games, you tend to die or disappear or, you know, something horrible and mysterious happens to you.
Of course.
In, let's see, what's one that I did recently? In Grimoire, the dice rolls are determining how big your character's spell book is, because the whole game is about writing out your witch's spell book. with all its spells. Mm-hmm. And your dice are determining how many spells you have and also what kind of components you get. And I personally found it very useful to have that, like, very bare bones information there for me to work off of. Because I found it very difficult to just go from one, finish it, and go to the next and build any kind of story that, like, made sense for me. Now, if you do the step-by-step-by-steps thing, there's going to be probably a little bit of weirdness, and that's probably okay. But if, for whatever reason, if you're uncomfortable with that, and you think the game can support it, try rolling out the random stuff and just, like, getting all that down. And then I went, like, 4 pulls on the Jenga tower before I got spaced. what does that story look like? What is the story of the guy who only lasted 4 pulls in a game of the wretched look like? That, sure. You might find that helpful. I know I have. Like I said, when I started this, I don't know whether or not that's frowned upon.
I mean,
in the solo role-playing community, if there is such a thing.
It's like you can say about any game, you know, the risk of having too strong an agenda as a game designer is just simply that the people who buy your game will ignore it. And I think that goes for procedures as much as it goes for setting, politics, anything else. The one thing I'd say is I personally think I would enjoy the tension a bit more. It would affect my writing, not knowing what was going to happen next. I think that's a matter of taste. I think doing it either way could work just as well. And it really depends on what you, the player, are looking for.
What else do we have? What other points can we cover to help people get into more indie games? Mechanically speaking. Or narratively speaking.
Well, ideally, if we want people to get into indie games, it's because we want them to play games that they like. If you're coming from a traditional background, how are you going to go find an indie game that scratches an itch that you want to scratch, that is something you want to play?
My brain jumps back to that Touchstone thing. That's where my brain goes first. D&D and traditional games, they tend to be very broad in what they can do. Now, I know D&D is a genre, right?
Yeah.
It's a genre unto itself. But under the D&D umbrella, you can play it a lot of different stuff. You could have a horror campaign. You could have an epic fantasy campaign. You could have a down-in-the-dungeons, gritty OSR-style campaign. And the same is true for a lot of traditional games, I think. Like, let's take Cyberpunk. Okay, you're playing in Cyberpunk 2020 or Cyberpunk Red. Okay, you're edgerunners on the, struggling to survive in a dystopian society. But, like, how are you actually doing that? Are you a bunch of solo mercs? Is it a media conglomerate? Are you all rocker boys trying to make it big? It's still very broad.
Now I want to run a game where everyone is a corporate and it's The Office. And this is all your fault.
No. Didn't we already do Shadowrun Corporate Edition? There were
We were managing a sporting goods store. That's not the same as doing Cyberpunk The Office.
That's true. But that's sort of my point. With a lot of traditional games, like with Eclipse Phase. Like, our biggest struggle with Eclipse Phase is, okay, what do you actually do with this game, right?
And mechanically speaking, the answer is a lot!
The answer is you could do a lot, right? With indie games, because they often come with that little touchstone of this is what the game is about. Well, all right, before you start looking, figure out, okay, what do I want to play? What am I looking for? What is the touchstone I'm looking to find? And then start looking for the game that possesses that touchstone. Oh, I want to play a bunch of, fighter aces. Okay, what about Tachyon Squadron? Oh, I want to play Teenage Superheroes. Masks. Oh, I want to play a dilettante noble writing to an art dealer to secure a quill.
Well, that's very specific. I mean,
Very specific, but, that's sort of what I'm talking about. You know what you want to play.
At the same time, knowing what you want to play is never going to get you to the point where you're sitting at a table with a copy of You're Trapped in Quarantine with Adam Driver and he wants to show you his latest script. It's on Itch. Go check it out.
It's great. It's great.
But my point there is, I actually wrote about this when writing about choosing new games, is that trying to go in with an idea of what you want to do already generally is very rarely going to lead you to an indie game. And sometimes it's a matter of, okay, taking a touchstone you're familiar with and figure out what you want to do with it. Like, especially if you want to move into Powered by the Apocalypse, it's because you want to think about characters. It's because you don't want to get bogged down in kind of the simulationist minutia. And if you want to get other smaller, more specific experiences, it really does help to know what you want to be different. Whether that means you want something more character-focused, whether that means you want something where the action hinges on the story and not on, like, the weight of the spherical cow that the designer used to design their fireball spell. You know? But I think what would help is maybe don't worry so much about what specific things you want, and instead look for some games that look interesting that you can play for one night. Because ultimately, one thing which I think every even moderately successful indie designer has in common is that they like playing a lot of games.
Mm-hmm.
And that sometimes comes across in how they design. Especially ones who have a big back catalog. And I mean, you know, if you start engaging with some of these designers as people and you start looking at their back catalog, you do things like noting, looks like Fraser Simons wrote The Veil and Hack the Planet and Veil 2020 and Retropunk. I wonder if he likes Cyberpunk.
I wonder. What a mystery.
But game designers write for people who think like them. And the big thing, which that is, more than anything else, they all have in common, is that they would all prefer to see different experiences when they're looking for different things, especially on the indie side. So get some different experiences. Maybe take your favorite trad game and then twist it. Maybe if you like Cyberpunk, go pick up a copy of The Veil. Maybe if you like Mutants and Masterminds or a Hero System, then go pick up Masks. Let it be different and kind of figure out what the differences are and enjoy the twist. So, I mean, I guess, Seamus, if your advice is find the thing you already like, my advice would be find something that you want to be different. Because at the end of the day, as much as I can roll my eyes at the fact that like 60% of the hobby plays D&D, you know what? If they're having fun with it, it's a game. I don't need to make you go explore the world. It's just, I think a lot of people want to, whether they realize it or not. You can find reviews, stories, advice, and game material on Cannibal Halfling Gaming. That's CannibalHalflingGaming.com.
You can find show and article updates at Hungry Halfling on Twitter. You can drop us a line there at CannibalHalflingGaming@gmail.com or on our Discord.
You can follow me on Twitter at Level1Wong. I probably won't be getting into any more Twitter fights because everyone who'd bother has already blocked me. You can listen to Cannibal Halfling Radio on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Spotify, and can give us a hand by leaving a rating and a review.
You can find me on Twitter at RGM79Ace, that's RGM79Ace, and you can support us at patreon.com/CannibalHalflingGaming, which lets us cover costs, pay our contributors, and save up for bigger projects. Like this one. Whatever else you do, the best way to get people to play more indie games is to run more indie games.
Whatever games you're playing, hope you're enjoying them. And if you're not, I have 16 bookshelves from which I can recommend you anything.
Play some games, have a good time, stay safe out there. See you next time.